those principles. Stories about people violating the company's values motivated less giving and more taking, particularly if they were about high-level leaders failing to live the principles. And if those events have already happened, it's hard to change those stories.
But what I could do every day is change how I behave. And so we started to see change that next day. I believe the senior leadership then infusing these behaviors into the company generated the record performance we had in 15, 16, and 17. And we're still at it. In fact, this year, because I feel like we made improvements, but it's starting to level off. What I'm doing this year, and I had my first session yesterday, in the next 3 to 4 months, I hope to talk to every one of these senior leaders in, because we now have seven formal behaviors that we've rolled out to the whole company. But what are the leadership behaviors? What's our additional responsibility and behaviors we need to demonstrate? And we're working on that now. And just, I mean, I'm not, you know, sitting in a room saying, here's what they are. I'm actually engaging that team to say, help, let's write these together. And I'm fully strongly believe behaviors set your culture, and you can't fake, you know, what you do every day sets your culture. You can't pretend to have a culture that's different than what you're really doing.
Culture researchers have distinguished between two kinds of values. There are espoused values, what principles people say are important. And then you have enacted values, the principles people show are important, through the behaviors they engage in and through the behaviors they reward and punish. Too often, I see disconnects between espoused and enacted values. And you can see it when you ask people to tell stories about what the culture of their workplace is like. The company website lists integrity, but the anecdotes are all about people cutting corners. Sometimes that happens because of hypocrisy, but other times it occurs for less nefarious reasons. It's often said that culture is what people do when no one's watching. This is especially common in big organizations, where you just can't see everything that's happening around and below you. So changing culture is often about closing the gap between espoused and enacted values, which can only happen if you spend time with the people who are struggling to enact the values you espouse.
Generally, the best decisions are made close, you know, with the people who are closest to what you're deciding to do. And one of the cool things we do is we do reverse mentoring. I remember when I was in product development, I used to meet with an engineer and talking and understanding his job and what are the pain points of his job, or, you know, what enables him to be better, and, you know, what he enjoys most. It really gave me a lot of insights on tools we needed to provide to make their work better, but also their perspective. And, you know, probably the best example I remember, they talked about, you know, you want us to raise issues early, because one of the things I always say at the company, you know, the best time to raise a problem is the minute you know you have it, because that's when it's its smallest. It's only generally going to get bigger if you can't solve it on your own, so raise issues. And he brought up to me, but, you know, I raise issues, and then all of a sudden I'm spending more time reporting out on the issue than I am solving the issue. And that actually caused us to change our process to say, and a lot of times now I'll you know, literally say to someone, you know, I don't need a PowerPoint deck on this. Just talk to me.
Mary makes a point of giving feedback to leaders on how their behavior comes across.
My style is to be very inclusive. And I, you know, even when I'm providing constructive feedback, say during a performance review with someone, I'll say, hey, here's my opinion. You know, you're a senior person, you know, this is my observation of how you're perceived. And do you understand that, you know, that's how you're perceived? And they'll be like, so it's not like, do this, do this. It's more, hey, let's talk about how you can be more effective. And I work hard to build relationships with my team to make sure that they know I want their views, even if it's different than mine, because I think together we're going to make better decisions.
That's really how I think culture change happens. One behavior, one action, one person at a time.
That's Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft.
I think one of the strangest things about power is most of us ascribe a lot more power to others over us versus our own ability to exercise our own power. And if you can flip it around, the reality is we have a lot more power than we, I think, give ourselves credit for. And if you can unlock it, that, I think, is true empowerment. And so that's how I've internalized it.
When Satya took the helm, he saw a culture that was ripe for change. Around the turn of the century, Microsoft had lost market share. There was infighting throughout the company, fueled by the stack ranking system where employees had to compete against their own teammates for high marks. even if they had a whole team of stars, managers were forced to follow a bell curve in performance reviews. They were measured twice a year on hitting targets, which spawned short-term thinking. Not exactly a boon for collaboration or innovation. So people spent a lot of energy trying to prove they were the smartest person in the room, instead of learning from others. And I kept seeing my own students who had gone to Microsoft leaving for more collaborative companies. Schedules in Davos were crazy. But Satya came to Wharton shortly afterward, and I had a chance to follow up on how he started the culture change.
So when Steve Ballmer announced that he was stepping down as CEO, you pretty quickly said, look, we're going to orchestrate a major culture change. I think the first quote I heard from you that went public was, for too long we've been the know-it-all company, and we need to become the learn-it-all company. That's not an easy message to deliver. What led you to that?
Yeah. In fact, if you look at even the distance between Microsoft and the competition in, say, late 90s, early 2000s, there was real daylight. It is natural that the culture, when you're doing so well, especially around the concepts that you invented, you felt like, yeah, you knew it all.
While Mary focused on changing employees' behaviors at GM, Satya's concern at Microsoft has been starting to change the way his employees think. He drew heavily on research by Carol Dweck, a psychologist best known for her pioneering studies of mindsets. On one end of the continuum, you have fixed mindsets, where people believe their capabilities and personalities are pretty much set like plaster. On the other end, you have growth mindsets, where people believe that skills and traits can change and adapt. Normally, we think about these mindsets in terms of people's beliefs that they themselves can change. But at Microsoft, Satya brought Carol Dweck in to convince people that the whole culture can change, that employees' skills and capabilities could grow, but so could the companies too. It's a work in progress. But you know you've made some headway when you have people taking it upon themselves to hold others accountable for culture change.
We are probably in the early stages of all of this because some people come to me and say, Satya, we found the four people in Microsoft who don't have a growth mindset.
You need to root them out immediately.
And I say, look, it's starting with me. It's my ability to recognize my fixed mindset each day that truly shows us as a learning company. But what you're probably talking about is the next stage where that is true. It is super important for us to recognize that some of the systemic challenges that exist have to be overcome, not just by personal correction, but by us collectively or individually pushing the system.
If I'm junior and I see something that's broken, what do you advise me to do to gain enough power to be able to get it on the radar and to be able to shape change?
I think first of all is whenever it is that you're evangelizing or you want change, is there example is better than precept. So is there any way you can set an example? That's kind of one of my first places where I go to is like, wow, by or your own action, can you at least instigate the first step of the broader change? Because you put one foot in front of the other. Because if you made the first step, it's much easier for the second step before you reach your ideal change state, if you will. That's what I would sort of, don't give up, be persistent, live by example. And those are all things that at least I will try to live by.
It sounds like it harkens back to Gandhi, be the change you wish to see in the world.
In some sense, yes, it is. And I think that's the only way to bring about change, because especially when people, you need followership, right? And the only way you get followership is when you're authentic, you're living by example. And it's otherwise just very, very hard, because it's otherwise just a set of words.
Satya's predecessor, Steve Ballmer, was known for his extroverted style. The web is littered with videos and memes of him in action with titles like Steve Ballmer going crazy on stage and Steve Ballmer monkey dance. Satya is much more introverted. One of his first actions was to reboot the annual strategy retreat for leaders. Instead of just inviting about 150 top executives, he also invited the founders of the startups Microsoft had acquired in the past year, even if they weren't senior in the company. Then he started sending execs out on shuttles to visit customers so they could identify better ways to work together and new problems to solve. And he turned the question of Microsoft's culture to the whole company, building cross-functional teams to blitz together on steps for change. And I've found in my own studies that when you need employees to drive change, introverts are actually more effective leaders than extroverts. They drive more profits in organizations, and they also have more productive teams. Why? Introverted leaders are more likely to ask questions and listen to suggestions from below, which means they get better ideas and they leave their people feeling more valued and motivated. In many ways, Satya embodies that. It's a look at how power is different today. Not shouting or dictating, but quietly stoking curiosity and encouraging change. True culture change only happens when people feel empowered to take ownership over the change. Because ultimately, it's their beliefs and behaviors that define the culture. Of course, it's still hard to change a culture without support from the top. But in a world of network power, leaders are finding that culture change depends on empowering people from the bottom up. And there are concerns that as technology advances, more and more people will be left behind. That's the focus of the next chapter. Before that, here are some power tips on culture change. If you're trying to drive culture change from a position of power, successful initiatives often start with gathering a core change team to identify the problem and then develop a vision and strategy. But that can go seriously wrong, which I got to see firsthand when I worked with a hospital to improve patient satisfaction. I got called in after their change team spent 8 months working on the issue and came back with one major recommendation. Staff should smile more. Yep, they actually wrote smile more. I asked them how in the world they got to that solution, and it turned out they started by studying what great service organizations do, and they got inspired by Disney and the Ritz-Carlton. They started down that path because they were getting a lot of patient complaints, but they never bothered to do a thorough analysis of their own internal data on the causes of the complaints. After I pushed them to do that, they were able to trace the complaints to a few departments, where the solution was definitely not to smile more. If you do a good job identifying the problem and formulating a compelling vision and strategy, the next challenge is to create a sense of urgency through the broader organization. I've noticed that most leaders do that by highlighting the expected benefits of the change. I get it. They want to be optimistic and encouraging and drum up excitement. But more often than not, that's the wrong approach. Because people are usually pretty positive about the status quo. If they weren't, they would have changed already. So if you want them to change, you have to destabilize the status quo. Which means leading with all the bad things that will happen if they don't change. In their Nobel Prize-winning research, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky showed that we play it safe when we're facing certain gains, but we're willing to gamble when we're confronting certain losses. I found this really useful in my own work when I'm trying to work with companies on changing cultures and getting them to embrace more original thinking. For a long time, I thought the way to go was to highlight all the benefits of creativity and innovation. But I found it way more effective to lead with the costs of not being creative and innovative. And so I like to ask them, how excited are you to be Blockbuster or BlackBerry? And the answer is usually not very, and then we can start a discussion about how to avoid that fate. The most resistance in culture change often comes from people with fixed mindsets. And researchers have shown that there's a 90-minute exercise that can be enough to foster a growth mindset that lasts at least 6 weeks. You start by asking people to reflect on a time when they've changed significantly. Then you ask them to make a persuasive case for why it's important to recognize that change is possible. And as they reflect on their own growth and generate reasons for why that matters, they end up being persuaded by somebody they already like and trust, themselves. And applying that to change, the Heath brothers have some excellent advice. If you encounter people with a fixed mindset about change, just send them off to find the bright spots. However you want the culture to work in your organization, there are probably already some pockets where that's happening. The challenge is to locate them, learn from them, and spread their habits and practices. There's actually a whole movement about this. It's called appreciative inquiry, where you change a culture by asking what's working instead of just asking what's broken. Of course, it's not either or, it's both and. We need to build on strengths and solve problems. Chapter 6, Robot Power.
We're not going to replace humans, we're going to make them smarter.
In the United States, about 40,000 people lost their lives due to traffic fatalities. 90% are related to human error.
AI's true democratizing force will be to give you the ability to be truly in charge of your attention.
So if we can use technology, we can dramatically impact the number of people who lose their lives, also those who are injured.
The new power that Eric Schmidt, Mary Barra, and Satya Nadella are describing is not a far-off fantasy. The tools we use every day are powered by artificial intelligence and machine learning. It's what happens when we train our computers and robots to get smarter and smarter on their own. According to many leaders at Davos, AI is positioned to usher in yet another new power landscape, one not shaped by the masses tweeting and selfieing their way up the power ladder. Instead, AI might do a lot of the work for us, the liking, sorting, figuring out what and who is best for us. It will vastly change our world, and you're already relying on it right now.
There was a great story just a little while back about Irish paramedics who were summoned to help a Congolese woman with a delivery in Ireland. And the problem was that the paramedics and the woman didn't share any language. And the way they solved that problem was by firing up Google Translate, which apparently was able to go back and forth between English and Swahili well enough to keep this woman calm, to comfort her, and to assist in the delivery of a healthy baby.
That's Andy McAfee, an MIT scientist who studies how technology transforms industries.
Now, I don't mean to get too Hallmark card about the whole thing. Man, I find it really hard not to walk away whistling when I hear stories like that.
Originally, AI researchers tried to teach computers to think like humans, and then they realized that it was much easier to just give computers a bunch of data and let the computers teach themselves to get smarter.
If you give it a big old sound file and the words that correspond to what the speaker was saying in that sound file, if you show it enough of those examples, it'll eventually be able to take a new sound file and accurately transcribe it. So that's machine learning, that's the dominant approach going on today.
So we thought we'd try it out with the big old sound file of my conversation with Andy. And here's what came back.
I really enjoyed the plug and play nature of Congress, that and I could be like earthworms and have a falling out.
To be fair, the machine mostly got the rest of it right. So it's not perfect, but AI is becoming more and more useful.
Sebastian Thrun is one of the rock stars of artificial intelligence, and he has launched an online learning company called Udacity.
Andy McAfee and I rode to Davos together through a blizzard, which might explain some of the sounds you're hearing in the background.
Udacity employs actual human salespeople to sit there and have chats with prospective customers about which of your courses should I take? Is this one right for me or not? And Sebastian realized that the log of all of those text interactions was an amazing training set for machine learning, because we know in every case if the person wound up signing up for a course or not.
Right.
So that's a success. And if they didn't wind up signing up for a course, like that's a failure. What patterns in the textual interaction were strongly associated with success versus which ones were associated with failure? And evidently, you get a pretty clear answer to that. Now, what they did not do was then create a chat bot to completely automate the interactions with their prospective customers. What they did instead was start teeing up to their human salespeople, hey, you might want to stress the salary bump that you'll get, or the fact that this program will only take 2 months as opposed to 6 months or whatever.
So it gives them a better library, a tested
library of things that they can do. And then to your point about what if the world changes, you got to keep monitoring that. You got to keep seeing if the association between say this and you have a good outcome is as strong as it was 6 months ago.
That's just one example. And also an early stage one, because AI is still in its infancy. Think back to the days of AOL and dial-up modems and chat rooms. Nobody could have imagined the power the internet and social media would unlock back then. And right now, AI is at a similar stage. Experts are predicting AI revolutions in fields like medicine, where patient diagnoses, pharmaceutical development, and medical devices can be amplified by data. Transportation will be reborn with autonomous vehicles. First cars and buses, but who knows what's next? Then consider how we get information and engage with culture. All the news and entertainment you want will come right to you. Not to mention socializing and dating. Pretty soon, apps like Tinder will swipe left or right for you. The opportunities are endless, and those are only the ones we can imagine. Now spread them around the globe and make AI-powered devices and information streams as prevalent as mobile phones are today. And it's easy to see how AI could shepherd in an entirely new era of power. And with it, new winners and new losers.
In general, I think we're going to do a better job of uncovering the Einsteins and the Steve Jobs and the Warren Buffetts and the Mahatma Gandhis of the world, these astonishing human beings out there, because the circumstances of your birth are I believe, going to matter less. The access to tools is going to be increased a great deal. And that I fervently hope that means that the elites that our open societies generate in the future have a much smaller percentage of white males born into comfortable backgrounds. We can do this. We have tools to help us get out of having that be the dominant share of the elites. I desperately hope we learn how to tap into those tools.
And yet, hope and promise are only one half of the story. Because while machine learning could empower billions around the world, it's far from risk-free. People are going to get displaced from jobs. And maybe more disturbingly, people might get displaced from many of the most important decisions in their lives. Rather than giving people power and agency, artificial intelligence could take it away. Let's look at the more nefarious, less obvious risk first. Because the magic in AI comes from code and algorithms that are often proprietary and invisible to the end user, it's often impossible to know who they're programmed to empower and what data they're using to make those decisions. The future may be filled with automated health insurance claims and home loans and driving routes home, but if we don't have visibility into how machines are making decisions, and more importantly, why, we risk empowering or taking power from the wrong people for the wrong reason. Take an algorithm that denies you a loan. You don't know if it's because you went to the wrong website or liked the wrong page on Facebook, or you happened to share a last name with a bunch of strangers who defaulted on their loans. And then how do you submit an appeal to an algorithm?
There are risks about the bias that we put into AI systems because of the training data that we give them. We have to understand the risks and threats and deal with them. But to me, that's a little bit like saying that we just need to talk about Mein Kampf when we talk about the printing press. I just think that's burying the lead and getting the situation pretty dead flat wrong. The printing press was a net benefit for humanity, even though it led to the printing and the distribution of Mein Kampf and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and all these other horrible books.
The key is to make sure that humans are still in control of the printing press, which is something that Satya Nadella has been steering at Microsoft, where they're building many of the platforms that AI runs on.
Because I think us abdicating control of the evolution of AI would be a bad design choice and a very bad ethical choice as well. But let's start with just even what is, I think, a real responsibility for any of us who are creating AI today is to make sure that we take accountability for the decisions the AI makes. That means you got to solve the problem of explainability so that we can reason over it.
If we can't see what's behind the algorithms, we're giving all of our power to them.
There are issues about the interpretability of these systems. They are black boxes, and we need to get them to be better at explaining themselves.
So for AI to continue advancing without threatening to disempower people, we need to look inside the black box, which will be a continual process as AI becomes a stronger and stronger presence in our daily lives.
The thing that I always push back on, though, this is a real concern. Adam, we human beings are also black boxes, and we are world-class explainers of our actions. If I ask you why you did something, you'll immediately give me an explanation that sounds pretty good to me and sounds pretty good to you. You're not consciously lying to me. But when we go look at what actually happened, in the cases where we can look, man, we humans are masters at giving really, really inaccurate explanations of our own behavior. So if I have the choice between a black box algorithm and a human being, a human decision maker, that doesn't know they're a black box, for heaven's sake, give me the algorithm.
But then there are the more tangible risks that threatens the livelihood of millions and maybe billions. If robots and machines can do more and more jobs, what's going to happen to the people who currently do those jobs?
Well, I understand the worry, but I don't think it's correct.
Once again, Eric Schmidt of Google.
I think the evidence is that because of automation, which has been going on for a long time, there will be more jobs, not fewer. And there's another challenge that nobody ever mentions, which is that because of declining birth rates and because of what is called the dependency ratio, the number of people working to the people not working, we're going to need our people who are working to work harder just to pay for the retirement and medical benefits of older folks. This is true globally, way. It's not just in the United States. It's in China. It's in Japan. It's already very serious in Japan. Portugal, many parts of Europe, Northern Europe, et cetera. How are you going to get that productivity out of this increasingly smaller set of very hardworking humans? You're going to help make them smarter. You're going to help automate them. So while there's certainly dislocation, and I don't want to minimize the local dislocation, in sum, there will be more unfilled jobs as a result of automation than people looking for work.
But that said, there's more automation, there's going to be displacement. I think we as a society will have to do some of our very best work in both teaching the boys and girls in school as well as anyone displaced at work, the new skills required for new jobs. And also we should keep a watch on policy.
The question then is how to best prepare. Of the 10 fastest growing jobs in America, half are in science and technology. Solar installer, wind turbine technician, statistician, mathematician, and software developer. Economists are projecting 250,000 new software developer jobs by 2026 in the U.S. alone.
I think the general rule is to learn analytical fields, whether it's STEM or STEM-related fields. But the ability to deal with complex analysis is critical. Many people are promoting universal teaching of data science. By that, I don't mean the underlying ways at which it works, but just to understand what data means, how it can be used. And that applies to pretty much everywhere, whether it's, you know, food production or sociology or what have you. So I'd like to start with that. There's always people who have a special mathematical aptitude, and they're going to be fine in this. But for the ones where math is a little bit challenging, let's still have them become sufficiently familiar that they can use these tools in the chosen course or profession.
But it also might make sense to train for jobs that require personal skills, whether managing a team or slinging coffee orders. The robots may be coming, but the robots are far from human, at least for now.
The robot home health aide is a long, long way away. The robot busboy is man. You know, never say never with technology, but that thing is not even on the drawing board yet.
Why is that? Because I just watched a video a couple days ago of a robot that did a backflip.
The backflipping
it was
robot.
Incredible.
Yeah, and that same robot was clumsy as heck just a couple years ago.
Yeah, so why are you not expecting the same thing to happen in these jobs?
The progress that company has made, Boston Dynamics is the company that makes those things, the progress in their robots continues to be crazy. That robot is heavy, still fairly clunky when it's not doing backflips. It can't do a side shuffle just because it can do a backflip. So it's really good at a fairly narrow range of tasks.
Right.
And in the latest video, that robot can jump around and do parkour. We still don't think it can side shuffle, though.
That robot is not very dexterous, and we're extremely dexterous. And that robot is very, very kind of energy intensive. It's very expensive, and it uses a lot of energy every minute that it's in operation.
So you're saying I should stop dreaming of living in the Jetsons?
In some ways, we're already living in the Jetsons. Keep in mind, George Jetson drove his vehicle to work, right? In the future, we are not going to be driving vehicles to work.
Yeah, but it was a flying car.
It was flying, and we might well have flying cars. But the robot, the Jetsons robot made, is one of the farthest away technologies. So I'm confident that like home health aide and busboy are two human jobs for a long time horizon going forward, and especially jobs that are not just one-on-one but one-to-many jobs that where you need to be good at tapping into other people's motivations, getting in the mind of another person, bringing a team together. Again, the robots are getting good at sensing emotions and doing things like that. The robot middle school girls soccer coach is a long, long way away.
I haven't met a robot that can empower a team or change a company's culture. And robots are pretty far away from being able to do the complex work that's involved in service jobs.
I think the fastest growing job category is care.
That's Sheila Marcello. She's the CEO of Care.com, a public company that helps millions of users per month find childcare, pet care, senior care, special needs care, and more. I told you half of the fastest growing jobs between now and 2026 would be technical and analytical. The other half are in care and service. Four of the top six are home health aide, personal care aide, physician assistant, and nurse practitioner. Within a decade, personal care and home health aides alone are expected to create more than 1 million new jobs in America. That's 10% of all projected job creation. And Sheila's seeing it happen in real time. She tells me about it on the bustling promenade at Davos.
And what we're finding is developed economies have a shortage of care on the supply side. And developing economies will be the source of that supply because there's only going to be increasing demand with low birth rates. And so I think that care is going to also force us to transcend boundaries, transcend gender, transcend social norms and roles. We're going to have to, because who is going to take care of each of us? And it's the human side, because artificial intelligence is not going to solve the issues that we have in front of us.
You know, each year at Davos, there is always one or two dominant themes.
Yeah.
And so this year, there really is, I think, the theme of automation and the future of society.
That's Laura Tyson. She's a professor at Berkeley's Haas School of Business, where she's also served as the dean. Before that, she was the dean of the London School of Economics and served on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, all roles that have brought her to Davos for years.
And the future of society includes the sort of job tracks and training tracks. And so people are saying, is coding necessary? Maybe coding's necessary, but it's not sufficient. It has to be coding with heart. It has to be coding. There's a whole bunch of discussion of soft skills. I mean, one of the things that people have said here as well, you essentially have gone from hand as a physical capability mm-hmm. to head as a cognitive capability. And now what really matters is heart. So all of these people who are interested in or thinking about power are actually also thinking about what is basically human. So there's a lot of talk about heart and empathy and care. And as we have more and more things taking out the cognitive and the manual, what are humans about?
It's one thing to train a computer to read facial expressions. It's another thing to teach it to guide a group through a decision about whether to move your headquarters or to build a robot that can manage the emotion in the room after a major project fails. Those are human skills. And psychologists first tried to draw attention to those skills about 3 decades ago.
We wrote this paper in 1990. It was really just a conceptual paper. And published it in a small journal. None of the major journals were interested in it. In fact, I like to say that paper was rejected from some of the best journals in our field.
That's Peter Salovey. He's now the president of Yale University. And that little paper he was working on coined the concept of emotional intelligence.
The essential idea is this. We have evolved an emotional system that provides us information. It's not something useless that we owe only to our animal heritage, but rather it is a way of getting information about our interactions in the world with other people and the like. And if we can learn to process that information, to read it, identify it, understand it, manage it, and then use it, it gives us an advantage. It's like having an extra sense. So we define emotional intelligence as a set of skills that can be measured, that can be learned.
We start learning emotional intelligence early in childhood.
How do you capture somebody's attention and then get them to focus on a conversation with you? And often that requires a bit of emotional skill, right? You have to, you're actually managing their feelings.
Emotional intelligence is often misunderstood. Peter clarifies that it's at least 3 different skills. The first is identifying emotions.
Emotions in yourself or in others, using nonverbal cues like facial expressions or body postures or what have you, but even identifying emotions in things that aren't human, so in a piece of music, in an artwork, and the like.
The second is understanding emotions.
That's really emotion language, and as you say, the relationship between different emotions. So when I first started in psychology, I studied envy and jealousy. So what's the connection between envy and jealousy? That would be an understanding emotions question.
And third is managing emotions.
I manage my own emotions when I psych myself up or calm myself down or hide my sorrow at a funeral or what have you. But you also manage other people's emotions. So telling a joke at the beginning of a talk or cheering up a friend or what have you, that's managing other people's emotions.
As I've studied emotional intelligence, I've come to believe that managing emotions is the most important skill. In a study I conducted in a healthcare company, I found that employees who had strong knowledge of strategies for regulating their emotions spoke up with ideas and suggestions more often, and they were more likely to be rewarded when they did speak up. They were able to rock the boat, but keep it steady.
I do know in the workplace studies we've done, where you, the outcomes are usually, you know, your performance reviews or how much you're paid or whatever, it is the managing emotion subscale of the four subscale that drives the effect.
As we think about the future of the world, but especially the future of work, do you think emotional intelligence is going to become more important as, you know, robots take over a lot of the left brain analytical jobs?
You know, we're going to have to remember, we're going to have to figure out what are the distinctly human additions, complements to what a machine can do. And, you know, I think those are going to involve strong emotional components.
I think we can be confident that robots are going to change our lives. They might be able to help us identify our own emotions and the emotions of others. But it's hard to imagine them managing our emotions for us. That's not something we can outsource or automate. And even if we could, would we want to? Robots might displace jobs, but they won't replace humans. So as much as emotional work is undervalued today, it might not be tomorrow. And so let's take a look at some power tips on building emotional intelligence. So if you want to increase your emotional intelligence, the first thing you can do is expand your emotional vocabulary. I think so often we use just a few emotion labels to capture the full range of experiences that we're having. So we talk about being happy or mad, but they're all different kinds of happiness, right? Joy is very different from contentment in terms of how intense they are. And if you understand that distinction, then it's a lot easier to figure out how to raise people's energy levels versus how to calm them down. Similarly, you know, there are different kinds of ways to be mad. You could be angry, which is, you know, being mad at someone else for the way that they've mistreated you. Or you could feel righteous indignation, which is about feeling like you're mad on behalf of a whole group that's been wronged. Or you want to attack and change a system that's broken and unjust. And the more of those distinctions you see, the better you can anticipate how you're going to feel in different situations, and also the more you can influence what other people are feeling. A second way to boost your emotional intelligence is to close your eyes and open your ears. People are always talking about the importance of facial expressions and body language, and let's face it, our nonverbal cues are full of signals about the emotions we're feeling. Right? You can recognize the smile of happiness, or the frown of sadness, or the gaping mouth of surprise. But there's a brand new series of studies led by Michael Krauss at Yale. And what he shows is that if you want to read people's emotions accurately, you're actually better off not looking at them at all and just hearing what they say and the tone of their voice. And I think part of the reason for that is that facial cues and body language they're messy. They're hard to interpret. I might see you smile. Are you smiling because you're really happy with what I just said? Or are you experiencing what psychologists call duping delight, which is the joy that a liar feels right when they're about to deceive someone and get away with it? I don't know. But when I listen to your vocal cues, to the tone of your voice, to how often you pause, to whether you stammer, I can not only read your emotions more accurately, I can also get a better sense of what's really behind them. And a third way to improve your emotional intelligence is to focus on that key skill we talked about, emotion regulation. One of my favorite studies was by Alison Wood Brooks, where she asked people to get into a really anxiety-provoking situation, like having to give a public speech on a topic they knew nothing about in front of a group of strangers, or having to sing karaoke while being videotaped. And before that, she asked people what they thought was the most effective strategy for managing their emotions. And over 90% of people said it's to calm down. You want to try to reduce your arousal. But Allison said, wait a minute, arousal is a high-intensity state. It's really hard to turn it off. It's like trying to slam on the brakes when you're already driving 100 miles an hour. And so she wondered whether instead of trying to calm down, you could take that intense emotion and just convert it into another one. So in one of her experiments, she had people tell themselves, I'm calm, I'm calm. And then she had another group tell themselves, I'm excited. And just saying those two words, I'm excited, significantly improved their karaoke accuracy and their performance on a math test that they were nervous about. And what I think is powerful about reframing anxiety or fear as excitement is when you're nervous or you're afraid, that's an emotion directed toward the future. And by definition, you do not know what the future is going to bring yet. If
if it were going to be a guaranteed negative outcome, you wouldn't feel anxiety or fear. You'd feel dread. And so the fact that you're nervous or afraid to begin with means that there's a possibility that it might go well. And that possibility it might go well means there's something good, even if it's not highly likely, to be excited about. And so I find myself applying this a lot as I get nervous for giving speeches or for situations that might be a little bit unfamiliar. When I think about what I'm anxious about, I also try to remind myself that there's a reason to be excited to be in this room to begin with. And that helps to manage the emotion more effectively. Chapter 7, Power to Truth. There's an aspect of power that we haven't yet addressed, and it might be the most important, because it involves not just how leaders gain power and wield it, but how the rest of the world lives. It gets back to why the World Economic Forum brings together these global leaders in the first place. How we educate children, how we protect our planet and venture beyond it, and how we help those without power.
One of the most important forms of power is cultural and emotional power.
That's Arlie Hochschild. She's a Berkeley sociologist who wrote an influential book called Strangers in Their Own Land. It's about supporters of the Louisiana Tea Party in the American heartland.
The folks I studied felt like the powers that be didn't understand them, didn't recognize any of their feelings, and that they were powerless. They felt estranged from the government, felt strangers vis-a-vis the government. I think we're part of a global trend. If you look at Eastern Europe countries, if you look at Hungary, at Poland, Austria, then go to Austria, Germany, France, the U.S., India. It's part of a larger thing.
Trust in institutions has been in decline. We're less likely to have faith in government, in the media, in scientists, and the loss of trust, and in some cases trustworthiness, in institutions that once stood for truth makes solving some of our most pressing global problems harder than ever. Ellen Stofan, NASA's former chief scientist, learned this firsthand.
I proposed a mission to send a boat to a sea at the North Pole of one of Saturn's moons.
I want to rewind in a second. You just said you wanted to send a boat to the sea of a moon of Saturn.
Yes.
Did I hear that right?
That's absolutely correct.
I mean, it sounds incredibly cool, but why?
Well, the sea is actually made of liquid hydrocarbons. It's liquid methane and liquid ethane, and it actually has a complete cycle, just like we have a water cycle here on Earth. It rains methane, it forms seas and rivers, it evaporates back up into the atmosphere. So you have this complete cycle, just like our water cycle. The only other place in the solar system where we have rivers, where we have seas, where you have open bodies of liquid, waves, all the processes we have here on Earth with water, it gives us something to compare the Earth to, which is why we study the other planets. In this sea on Titan, there could be life. It might not be Earth-like life because we're lacking water, but it still could be life. Oh. And so Titan is a place to go to start exploring that question of what are the limits of life? Is everything have to be like the Earth, or can you go down a different path? And to me, that's super intriguing and fun.
It's amazing.
And you can say, all right, right there, that's like crazy. And ultimately, we didn't get selected.
In the old days, a top executive or chief scientist might have just made the decision, and the public would have read about it in the news and trusted it was a decent idea.
We've always been very happy to be off in our corner doing our cool science, exploring the universe, understanding the Earth, all these things. We're happy to work on those problems for humanity.
But the institutions and the people who work there no longer get the benefit of the doubt. And scientists who are used to keeping their heads down now need to speak up and advocate for their work.
Now that the scientific community has understood climate change for now well over a decade, the fact that we are still struggling to influence policy, and especially at the rate at which policy needs to be changed, is extremely frustrating to the scientific community. I think now people are really struggling from, you know, the vaccine problem to climate change. How do we become influencers? And there's a lot of the scientific community who says, oh, we should stay out of politics. We're not political. Yes, you are, because what you're finding is something that needs to influence policy.
Yeah.
And that takes you into the political realm, whether you like it or not. And my struggle is, how do scientists find a voice?
Is there anything that you think is going to move the needle?
I wish I had an easy answer to that. I think it's not scientists alone. I think we've really had to turn to the social sciences to say, how do you influence people when you're telling them bad news, when you're trying to change behavior that people don't want to change? And so I think so the scientific community, especially over the last couple of years, has really said, you know, we can't solve this problem on our own. We need to reach out to the social sciences. We need to actually, to me, reach out to the arts community, because when you start thinking, how am I going to convince the public on climate change?
Yeah.
You know, we need novels, we need plays, we need movies that are based in reality. You know, this is an all hands on deck kind of challenge that our planet is facing.
As a scientist, you're trained to be a dispassionate observer. When you get involved in driving change, it's too easy for you to appear political or partisan, which undermines the very credibility you're working to establish.
And scientists can't do it alone, and I think that's one of the things the community has realized.
Stories are so much better for convincing people or bringing people in than data.
That's Sue Desmond-Hellman, the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They launched in 2000, and now they're the world's largest foundation. But they often find themselves facing the same basic challenge as NASA, organizing and convincing others to advance their priorities. One of my favorite illustrations is a study where people watched a presentation, and only 5% of them could remember a statistic from it. But 63% of them remembered a story. I think that's a statistic worth remembering. So the Gates Foundation, where I've done some consulting work, is trying to get better at telling their stories and trying to get more comfortable doing it in the public sphere. Because just doing good work is no longer good enough.
And a classic thing is, if you don't believe me, I'll say it louder. So we are learning from social scientists how to be convincing. Having facts and truth as best we know it today is the only way we can rationally give people good advice about their lives. I think we have to make science more real to people. Even the word science is almost surely the wrong word. I was talking to somebody the other day about gravity. You know, we talk about science like, well, vaccines and medicines and things, flu shots. We were talking about flu shots. And they said, well, you know, I just don't trust science. And I said, what I think we all should say is, you trust science all day long.
Yeah.
You know, you trust science all day
every
long.
Every time you step on the brakes in your car.
Every time you step on the brakes in your car, I often am trying to talk my husband into cross-country skiing. And he says, no, I want that chairlift. I want gravity, because it's fun to go down the hill. And he's a scientist, too, so he would be citing gravity as a reason he wants to go downhill skiing. But what he's saying is what we're all living, which is we use science and technology all day long.
Mark Sussman is the president of global policy and advocacy of the Gates Foundation, where he's also the chief strategy officer.
Facts on their own are not, they are persuasive to a small subset of people who may be overrepresented at the Gates Foundation. But if you're trying to actually get traction in the real world, you need to position and place your messages in slightly different ways. Not that move away from facts, but that connect it in at a more human level and with elements of people's lives that they can understand.
Of course, we need to think about how we deliver the message, appealing to emotions as well as facts, to use pathos and logos, as Aristotle called them. But with disinformation and mistrust of the media and institutions running rampant, we need to consider the source of the message as well. Aristotle called attention to this third factor that he called ethos. It's about establishing the credibility of the person who's delivering the message. My colleague Dave Hoffman and I ran an experiment with fundraising callers at a university. The manager knew it was important to help the callers understand where the money they raised actually went. So they invited two different leaders to come in and talk about how the funds were used. But it had no impact on the caller's performance. When a scholarship student came in, though, to talk about benefiting directly from that money and how it made a difference, the average caller more than tripled in money raised over the next 2 weeks. The leaders seemed to have an ulterior motive. The callers knew someone was trying to convince them to work harder. Whereas the beneficiaries came across as authentic. They brought the impact to life in a credible way. We called it outsourcing inspiration. And yet, getting better at telling stories is only one half of the playbook for institutions to regain power today. The other half is employing the very network that has taken away their traditional power in the first place. Because if they can't achieve change from the top down, they have to do it from the bottom up. For the Gates Foundation, that means trusting and empowering local partners on the ground. These partners know the issues better than anyone else. They've earned the trust of their communities, and they're better positioned to truly institute new programs and initiatives than an executive sitting in some office across the ocean.
Something I think is in short supply was humility. Humility starts with saying, we don't know the answers. And often, if we'll sit and listen and ask good questions, we'll hear the answers.
Why is that humility in such short supply? Why do you think it's so rare when people go and try to solve problems?
When you work on something, you like to believe you're convinced it must be the right thing. And so you're being carried along by your own passion. And the challenge is things don't work and are not sustainable unless they are truly community-owned, embraced, embedded in the people there. And that's a difficult lesson. It has to be learned over and over again. I wish it didn't have to be.
You want to use your skills. Everyone is so eager to help. I'm eager to help. I want to use any assets I have to help and give back. And so the instinct might be, I will tell you how to help. And in fact, the lesson over and over again, that humility and listening, is that the power comes from setting the conditions, using our assets with our partners and setting the conditions to bring up their power.
The story of the Gates Foundation is in many ways representative of the landmark shift in the way power works today. A trusted institution founded by Titans with extraordinary resources believes that the key to continued success will come from empowering its partners and those it serves. It's their stories and success on the ground that will make the difference. I've worked with quite a few leaders who have bold visions but struggle to turn them into compelling stories. One of the reasons is that they're too abstract. They talk in words instead of pictures. It's ironic for an audiobook, I know. My colleague Drew Carton has done research on this problem, and he finds that even when you literally instruct leaders to talk in images, they still fail to make them vivid. But there's a workaround. He calls it mental time travel. So imagine yourself in the future with your vision realized. Take a picture of what you see and describe it. Drew's tested that with corporate executives and government leaders, and they end up creating much more illuminating visions afterward. So I want you to imagine a world where people are not held back by hope and despair, but instead feel empowered to drive change. What would that look like?
I grew up in a household where there were always civil rights activists.
That's Carrie Kennedy. She runs a nonprofit that fights for human rights. And I've saved her for last, because of every conversation I had in Davos, hers had the most emotional impact on me. Because she has a crystal clear vision of how to empower those who need it the most. We're sitting outside on the main promenade in Davos, with snow falling from the rooftops around us.
When I learned to tie my shoes, I made sure if I put my left one on first, I tied my right one first. Because I...
Really?
Yeah, because I want there to be justice.
Justice for your shoes.
I mean, you know, right? So for in every aspect of life.
Wow.
So that's a headset. Where do you get that from? You get that from your parents. So that was kind of the what was going on in our household. And so I really credit my parents for exposing all of us to that. And I don't think, like, I don't remember my mother once looking at a report card. I was a terrible student. So it was just not an issue with her. But she cared deeply if you went and, you know, went to a soup kitchen. That was a big discussion. Or what we did on our summers, because most of us went in and worked on Indian reservations or with farm workers or something like that. That was what was valued in our house, and I think that made a difference. And I also think there was a lot of discussion. There was an expectation that everybody would read the paper and be able to talk about what was in it. And there was a lot of discussion. So, for instance, we pray at night, thank you, God, for this good food. Thank you for the hands that made it. Help those who don't have food to eat tonight. Okay. So you say that again and again and again, but then there'd be a discussion. Well, who are the hands that made it? What would it be like to be picking tomatoes or being a farm worker? What would you be able to go to school? What would happen to your family? Where would you live? How'd you get health care?
You might be surprised by the way Carrie grew up. She wasn't raised by hippies on a commune. She was basically American royalty.
My father, who's Bobby Kennedy, was the seventh of nine. And so I think, you know, when I think about his life and his work, and today's, this year is the 50th anniversary for his presidential campaign and of losing him, I think that role in his family really impacted his capacity to have empathy for people his whole life. And some people have said he spent much of his life saying, get your boot off his neck. That's a power dynamic. Mm-hmm. That's stopping the bullies.
Yeah.
And it's stopping the bullies in the very narrow personal areas, and it's stopping the bullies structurally. So my work is carrying forward his unfinished work on social justice. And so essentially what we're doing is getting the boots off the necks. And but we're also very cognizant of the fact that people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution.
In 1987, Carrie established a nonprofit, Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, to continue her father's work to promote peace and justice. She believes in creating empathy and driving change from the ground up.
If we hold the governments responsible and the corporations responsible, it's for naught if we don't get the next generation involved. So we do human rights education all around the world to empower people and show that they can make a difference. Children, kindergarten, students through law school, all the way in between.
So along with advocacy and litigation to stop human rights abuses, a major part of her work is creating lesson plans for schools, which engage kids on their terms, with chocolate. Okay, that would not have worked for me, because I've hated chocolate since I was a kid, but it seems to be highly effective with her audiences.
So one of my favorite lesson plans is for 12-year-olds. 12-year-olds around the world take something called language arts, which when I was a kid, it was called English.
Yeah.
Now it's called language arts, and they have to learn poetry, and they have to learn expository writing, etc. So we give them two or three articles about children in manufacturing chocolate. 70% of the chocolate consumed in the United States, Japan, the UK, here in Switzerland, is made by children in slavery or
Are
child
you
labor.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
70%.
I'm so glad that chocolate now.
Oh. Each time you eat a piece of chocolate, you're probably touching, you know, somebody who might be a slave or child labor. So we give the kids these articles, and they have to write a poem in iambic pentameter called Dear Bobby, explaining what it's like to be in child labor. So they're doing text analysis, they're social-emotional learning, there's empathy about imagining what it's like to be one of those kids, and poetry. They're writing it in iambic pentameter. Then the next lesson plan is expository writing. So we give those kids the same articles, and then we give them the name and address of the CEOs of Godiva, Hershey's, and Mars.
Wow.
And now they have to take something that was an emotional issue and translate it into an advocacy piece with the facts. Then the last thing is near Halloween, and we give them a card, and they have to consolidate their thoughts into one sentence with the problem is. And they say there's a solution, and it's fair trade chocolate. Then they scotch tape a piece of fair trade chocolate to the card. And on Halloween, they do reverse trick-or-treat. So whenever somebody gives them a piece of chocolate, they say, thank you so much, and they hand back the card.
Wow.
So at the end of that series of steps, the kids are transforming themselves into human rights defenders. And that is the most revolutionary thing we can do. It's not stopping child labor, but it's making each of those kids say, I'm a defender. This is how I walk through life. I'm empowered. I'm not a victim anymore. I can create change.
I love that. What I think is so brilliant about that is you're not just educating them, you're empowering them to act.
This is advocacy storytelling at its best, putting ideas that matter into a narrative that can have influence immediately. Another similar lesson plan involves studying an environmental activist from Kenya. In a high school classroom in Italy, two kids were inspired.
Two of these kids are like 15, 16 years old, decide to do a photo essay on recycling. So they buy a newspaper and a Coca-Cola, and they take pictures of buying it, and they take pictures of reading it and drinking it, and they take pictures of putting it in the recycling bin. Then they take pictures of the recycling truck picking them up. Then they get on their bikes and they follow the recycling truck all around the city. And then they follow the recycling truck to the dump, and they take pictures of it dumping the recycled stuff into the pile of all the other stuff. Okay? So completely corrupt.
Yep.
Then they take that to the local newspaper's front page story. Then they take the paper to the mayor, and the mayor fires the recycling company.
Wow.
So, you know, maybe next year they might have to do the same thing with the new recycling company. But the point is that those kids...